This is from the introduction of Randy Copain's book, Camouflage Through Limited Disclosure. It's the introduction. 59 years of data collection has been applied to the enigma of extraterrestrials visiting Earth. A resulting pattern of evidence emerges from this collective inquiry. This data pattern indicates a host of complicit individuals who are shown to be possessing affirmative extraterrestrial evidence. Identifying these people has indicated the enclave of their careers, the military-industrial complex. Residing within this complex is a system for managing ET evidence, a contingency for popularizing ETs. The most persuasive account of this scheme is detailed in The Day After Roswell by Colonel Philip J. Corso. The cases presented in this book are internally consistent and reinforce the assertions of Colonel Corso. These independent voices of experience are Melinda Leslie and William Bill Uhouse. Together, the combined body of data from these three sources gives a cause to rethink the cover-up model of why ET evidence is undisclosed. Colonel Corso has already explained the management of ET knowledge in his chapter entitled The Strategy. It is my contribution here to begin reconciling Corso's unofficial disclosure. Let me welcome to the airwaves Randy Copain. Randy, thank you so much for joining us here on KPFK.
Well, thank you very much for the invitation.
Yeah, absolutely. Yes. Now, I've known you for quite a while, and knowing that you have sat down to compile some of your thoughts about what you have been investigating since I've known you, but I know that the investigation has gone much longer, because you're a longtime listener at KPFK, right?
That's very well, and that's my cue, because I wanted to say, well, let me acknowledge that. Yes, indeed, I have been studying the UFO phenomenon itself increasingly in a formal or quasi-scientific method since about 1985. And in point of introduction, I just wanted to say something, because you have a special guest in the sense of me, not to blow my own horn, but in a very special way, that is, because as I was saying before we started here, I consider myself a graduate of Roy Tuchman's Something's Happening Omniversity of the Air, of the airwaves.
That's great.
Roy and I are not friends, but I'm sure he'll remember my name, because I've been a longtime listener. I started listening to on the late night show at KPFK way back in 1964 when there was a program, as I was telling you earlier, there was this program called Radio Free Oz, and it was and it was like a psychedelic late night program. I used to stay up late with my transistor radio, you know, because I was only like 16 years old, and it was hosted by Peter Bergman, who later went on to create the fire sign psychedelic theater of the air there at KPFK also. And then, you know, some years went by, and then Roy took over, and he's been there ever since. And it's very remarkable. There's a connection there in what we're going to talk about tonight, because at a point in time, I think in the early 90s, forgot exactly the years, but Roy used to have a regular feature on his program. It was called the UFO Hotline Update, and it was actually a phone service, and I think it was hosted by this guy who was the son of, I think, the TV actor, Dennis Weaver. I think that's who it was. Anyway, they'd have these hotline updates like every week or every few days or whatever, and you'd call the hotline number on the phone, and then they'd give you the update on the various sightings and new developments. I mean, it was very incredible, and Roy made it a permanent part of his program for a certain period of time. And in fact, there was a reason for that, because Roy divulged to some degree during that time period that he himself had some kind of an encounter or a sighting. I don't know what the details were, but
Roy,
he always did acknowledge that.
Oh.
And that's why he felt the whole scenario, on the one hand, was believable, but on the other hand, it's fraught with a lot of political problems, which kind of like goes with the territory, and it's hard to sort that out, and you really do have to study it to do that. And so ever since, I took it upon myself, because of my interest in various, through various sources, to be inspired to do that, and it ultimately culminated, you know, in attending the conference on a regular basis and doing my real homework, and then collaborating with someone whose separate independent research is featured in the book.
Yes.
who is my collaborator. Her name is Melinda Leslie, and she has both experience and as well as you know, unearthing information from a research standpoint.
Yes.
And so my book is divided into three parts, and her part is part two. And what we've done is we've looked at the kind of like big picture based on what's documented from various more authoritative sources, such as the person you were quoting there by reading the introduction, namely Colonel Philip J. Corso. Corso wrote this book, and it came out in 97, called The Day After Roswell. And it really kind of like put ufology, or the community of people who are dedicated to researching this issue, he kind of like put them in a tailspin. And frankly, one of my motives for writing our book was based on certain things that he said in two of the chapters. It wasn't just like passing commentary. Two of his chapters were devoted to, one, the issue of the cover-up, and two, an explanation for what actually the cover-up is about. And I took that as a model of investigation. I said, well, this Corso guy's got a great unassailable biography, and if he was dreaming this up, I'm not really sure why he would. So let's just take a proposition that he makes in the book, and then we'll just use that as a model for basically reevaluating everything that we think we know about the UFO phenomena. Now, if you have had an experience, not you personally, but I mean rhetorically, if one has had any type of, any level, you know, Close Encounter 1, 2, 3, 4, or whatever, of this phenomena, which continues at a very actually substantial degree even right up to this day. In other words, if you had an experience and you were convinced this was true, and then you start to look into it and you're persuaded that it really is true, well, if it is true, it would continue right along, day by day by day. It would not kind of like fade away because people were mistaken or they were being fooled by hoaxers or whatever. And, of course, that's what history has borne out. And the reason why I began the introduction as you read it, actually, I should change it now because now we're into 2007. The book actually came out in December of 2006, but now officially, or about officially, in July of this year, ufology in a formal way is now a senior citizen. It's going to be it'll be 60 years since 1947 this year, and that's, in my opinion, plenty enough time for the phenomena to continue, information to be compiled about it, and then for people like me to begin to look into the phenomena itself as it affects society at large as a legitimate phenomena, and that's basically what I do in the book.
Right, right. So finally, with the use of 60 years now coming up this year of data and collection, you can really get a bird's eye. You can get a trajectory from the initial accident and others and really see the pattern.
Right, that's right. You're not going to develop substantial patterns in the sense that we have to develop the information unless you have a long period of time. And in fact, that's what I say.
Yes.
I say we're at a point in time now where we can evaluate it from a standpoint that we were never able to do before simply because we didn't have enough time yet.
Now, I understand why you picked Colonel Corso. Tell us a little bit about Melinda Leslie and how she worked to help you recognize what is some of the different factions and elements of the UFO cover-up.
Well, first of all, let me define why it is that I named the book what I named.
Okay.
Because without the subtitle, it's kind of like a Zen koan or something. It doesn't really make any sense to the average person. If you've looked into ufology, you might get the hint that it relates to the cover-up, but I don't actually say that overtly in the phrase. Camouflage through limited disclosure actually is a quote. It doesn't have the quotes on the cover, but it's a quote by Corso himself to basically boil down, as he says in Chapter 6, the strategy. The strategy is this... basically it's a process, a sociological process for society at large to acclimate themselves to the facts of this phenomena. And so basically the meaning of camouflage through limited disclosure is that the cover-up itself is not a cover-up of ETs. As I was saying a minute ago, if the phenomena is legitimate, then it has a life of its own. So no one's going to cover it up because, you know, who could control whatever's happening? It's beyond control. So the cover-up is actually what they have. There's this term, you know, that I'm sure you've heard of many times on KPFK, that was a concept developed by the CIA. It came out as a formal concept during the Iran-Contra investigation. It's called perception management, because the CIA has infiltrated media at large throughout the world, and that's all been fully documented. And so they had this phrase that they came up for managing the perceptions of society to think in a certain way. Well, if you apply that as a concept to what Corso is explaining as far as the way the cover-up actually works, that's what the cover-up is. It's not to hide ETs. No one could hide ETs. It's to acclimate the fact that this is a real phenomenon for society, but that it's not something that the authorities, even if they wanted to, disclose, because it's not simply something that you would say to, like, you know, the population of the United States. The UFO phenomenon is a global phenomenon. So any disclosure about it, regardless of who's saying it, if anyone in authority was to actually do that, it would be a global revelation to the population of planet Earth. And because of the sociological, theological, epistemological, existential, et cetera, you name it, it would disaffect it in substantial way for many people. For you and I, we'd be glad about it if they had a disclosure. But I'm here to tell you that if we look at it now and evaluate it from the standpoint that we give it the benefit of the doubt, it's a legitimate phenomena, there are really extraterrestrials, they're coming here now. They have been coming here now. And if we acknowledge that they are here, then they could have come here at any time throughout the entirety of history of mankind. And there's no way to disparage that as a possibility. Mm-hmm. That would be one of the reasons why they could never disclose it. That and many, many, many other reasons. Now, as far as Melinda goes, the reason why Melinda and I have teamed up is because her experience in her own life, as well as when that prompted her and inspired her to become an investigator of that which she has experienced, actually ties into this whole proposition as far as the cover-up, because the experience that I'm referring to...
You know what, Randy? What? Let me just do a quick... Let's do a little cliffhanger here, okay? Because
okay.
I gotta tell folks that they're tuned to KPFK 90.7 FM Los Angeles, 98.7 FM in Santa Barbara. On the line's Randy Kopang. We are discussing his book, Camouflage Through Limited Disclosure, Deconstructing a Cover-Up of the Extraterrestrial Presence. And it's fantastic because he's talking about, hello, it's coming up on the 60-year anniversary of the Roswell crash, and isn't it time that there can be some patterns recognized through all the disclosures that are out there? And that's what he is talking about this evening. Fantastic to have him here. Long-time listener, long-time friend of Roy's, and so, hey, it's about time. Mm-hmm. So let me just do this quick break, and we'll be back with Randy right after this short break. Radio Alchemy.
Eclipsing conventional wisdom. All alchemists converge at www.radioalchemy.com for streaming audio and more.
And you know, darlings, way to get to Radio Alchemy is through www.kpfk.org. It streams worldwide, so you guys can get us wherever you are, anytime you want. Lots of great things happening that are up there right on the website. And so, hey, doggone it, click on it, find the Something's Happening program guide. Oh, Radio Alchemy's there. It's on political night with all the rest of us person out there agitating for your action, because, boy, do we need for your healthy bodies to get working. And so, you know, let's get to it. All right. After just another second or two, we'll be back with Randy Kopang to discuss his book, Camouflage Through Limited Disclosure. And so, Randy, we left on a lovely little cliffhanger.
Cliffhanger.
Yes.
There you go.
Yes.
Yeah, I was about to refer to what my colleague Melinda Leslie is up to. Melinda has been researching for a number of years, and actually she's quite a professional presenter because she's been doing her research and presenting it at conferences and lectures and MUFON meetings and the radio and TV, et cetera, for quite a number of years. And she had a lecture series down Orange County where she lives for 9 years, and she never missed a month. She had all the people who are the prominent people in ufology and or otherwise come through there, and so she's been able, through her association with all the major researchers and certainly the ones involved in the quote-unquote abductee phenomena, to actually have a very inside overview of the particulars of that phenomena in light of a different but subset of abduction phenomena. And that's wherein there's not a lot of these people, but perhaps a few hundred of them throughout the country, and she's interviewed them, many of these people, and in fact such cases are documented in a number of books. She's trying to put together a book of her own specifically about this, but I decided to collaborate with her on the kind of like sociological implications of what I'm about to describe vis-a-vis the cover-up and the phenomena in general. Now, the phenomena that I'm referring to specifically as a subset of abduction research is a situation where certain abductees are actually kidnapped against their will for short periods of time. Actually, the time period wherein this occurs only lasts for maybe 4 or 5 hours at the most. It doesn't last for days or anything. And they're actually, but the technical term would be that they're actually kidnapped, and they're brought to nondescript military bases, and they're interrogated. And they are interrogated and kind of tested about the experience that they had when they were abducted, or to the degree that there is evidence for them being abducted, in the sense of the alien experience or the close encounter experience. Now, a lot of people who are skeptical of this whole issue itself—I mean, ufology or UFO phenomena or whatever, extraterrestrials—they would think that anybody who claimed that is being misled to believe that there was anything to it in the first place, and what's really going on is some kind of mind control situation. Well, the reason why we collaborated on this book is to present a comprehensive overview of many things that otherwise don't seem to be related, that actually converge in a number of circumstances within greater ufology that both would seem to both confirm and deny the skeptical point of view. Now, that actually is a paradox, and skeptics would be laughing now to hear me say that. But the reason why I do say that, and the reason why I acknowledge it as such, is because what we need to do, if we can concede the possibility that, and even skeptics are being forced into this now because of the proliferation and growing sophistication of information about the phenomena itself generally, that is that we have to reconcile that perhaps a lot of theories as to what's actually going on from a skeptical point of view were actually premature because, as I said earlier, we haven't been able to research the greater phenomena for a long enough period of time when we can see patterns that otherwise may lead people to have, you know, working hypotheses that either are pro or con about it overall. Mm-hmm. And that's part of the mystique and the mysterious nature of this phenomena itself. Because if there are any aliens, and I firmly believe that there are, but I just say that in a rhetorical sense, they obviously are not overtly disclosing themselves, although obviously they could. And one of the insights that Melinda and her research have gained through her interviewing, extensive, very systematic and scientific interviewing of these people who claim to have been kidnapped and interrogated by humans about their abduction experience, what she's found in the systematic interviewing of people about that is that one of the main reasons why there isn't any disclosure is because when you say that the ETs are aliens, you come to find out that you mean exactly that. In other words, they're not people. And I don't say that disparagingly. What I really mean by that is that the authorities could not disclose this overtly to the public, because if they did, the public would not be able to relate to it at all, because they, and the people in authority, realize the significance of what the connotation of extraterrestrial actually means, in the sense that the ETs, their sense of being, and I mean this genetically, are actually at an entire level, different altered state level of consciousness altogether than human beings. And if the authorities were to disclose that reality shift, that, you know, ETs are here and now we know all about it and we're going to tell you that this is the fact, then it would cause an existential quandary in many levels of perceptions of society at large, human culture itself, technological development, and what actually could have been being done covertly to actually direct humanity in a direction that they didn't actually have total autonomous control over. And in a way, that's what Colonel Corso says in his book, because what his book is actually about, Day After Roswell, it's not really about extraterrestrials at all. It's about the possibility that if there were crashed flying saucers, the obvious thing that the military would do, who actually have possession of them, where they would try and, A, figure out how they worked, and B, duplicate what they found out. That would lead to any number of tangential technologies, as we learn more about advanced technologies that the ETs technology was a model for, and then we would actually do things with it. Well, that's exactly what Corso claims has happened since 1947.
Mm-hmm.
That a lot of technological developments that humans have furthered and marketed in society at large, the core fundamental principles involved were derived from extraterrestrial technology. Now, that doesn't mean that our replication of that in any way approximates an ET technology, but we're talking about principles. Principles and a greater understanding of electrophysics, mm-hmm. et cetera, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
And in the interviewing of the abductees by the people who have been interrogating them about their ET experiences, one of the main reasons why, in other words, this is a recurring theme amongst the people that Melinda has interviewed, one of the main things that they want to know is about extraterrestrial technology. So if you're a skeptic and you were saying, oh, no, no, this is all just bull, and they're just dreaming this up and fooling these people about it, tell me what the payoff would be for making the abductee believe that she was being interrogated about their knowledge of an extraterrestrial form of technology, and on top of that, their actual experience that seemed to have warranted this interrogation was actually correct, because many of the people who were interrogated in this way actually claimed to actually know about extraterrestrial technology.
Do you?
So tell me that's not a coincidence.
Right. Exactly. It's so they want to. So are you saying then the folks such as Melinda Leslie and that their abduction stories you believe are real, and it is backed up by military abductions,
right,
harass them into divulging what technology they experienced during this abduction? Is that what helps fortify the stories of abductees?
That's what Melinda's contention is. Her contention, when she speaks about her research, one of her main motives is to say that the military abduction phenomena validates the credibility of the strictly ET encounter experience. And as you may know, I'm sure you do know, since you've been attending these conferences quite a bit in the last few years, even to this day, ever since it surfaced really as an area of research, the abduction phenomenon, it's still the hardest thing to deal with by even people in the UFO community.
Yes.
It's so enigmatic, and there's an explanation for that. And that's one of the things that we addressed in the book. And that has to do, there again, with technology. But let me step back before I develop that, what I mean by that, vis-a-vis the abduction phenomena, because our working hypothesis has settled on an explanation for what actually the ET presence is all about. And R. Weringham-Bothus has suggested that one of the primary values to read into this is that what the ET presence symbolizes is actually two things, technology itself, technological development, and consciousness, in our case, human consciousness. And the reason why we put it like that, that at the core of the most core fundamental issue of what ET activities are about on planet Earth, covertly, which they are, and I admit that they are, is about technology and consciousness. Now, how would that work? It works in the sense, and this leads us back to your question, that the way technology that ETs have works is that basically it's a function of, just like human technology seems to be, it would be a function of their genetically born capabilities, their physiological and mental traits, right? When you make a technology, in fact, let me even add another layer of analysis on top of this, since you're friends with Bob Dobbs, who advocates McLuhan. I'm a student of McLuhan myself, and I found great insight into McLuhan's study of media, and by which he means the technologies whereby humans extend their various physiological or sensorial capabilities, which are, of course, genetically rendered
right.
as each person is born, right?
Right.
So all the technologies that we have are various extensions of the body. Likewise with the extraterrestrials. Although, the reason why I made the point in emphasizing how alien they are, all the evidence that you've ever read, and certainly the contactees back in the 50s or the abductees in more recent times, or any variation thereof. What is the common theme? The common theme is that the means of communications that are alleged to have occurred are always telepathic, mm-hmm. are always involving paranormal capabilities mm-hmm. of a clairvoyant or psychokinetic level,
mm-hmm.
and therefore it would make sense, logically, if that was the case. In other words, if those reports were accurate, and primarily aliens are unlike human beings in the sense that their nature of their whole sense of being is basically telepathic, telekinetic, etc., etc. If that was the case, then their technology would actually have to comport with that. In order for humans to understand the technology, if the issues of the crashed saucer phenomena is accurate, then basically we would never actually ever be able to use ET technology because their technology would be interfacing and merging their technology with that more altered state of consciousness with which all evidence shows that they have.
Right.
And so what this all would boil down to would be, as far as like the people that Melinda has been researching, is that in order to better understand what we can possibly know about extraterrestrial technology, or even if it were just theoretical, they would have to try and get the best evidence that they could have to get insights into how the ET technology worked. And, of course, if there are people out there who are claiming they've had contact with them, well, you can bet your bottom dollar that they'd be a prime suspect for interrogation to find out how it worked.
But why would they have to go to abductees when you have people like Colonel Corso and the military that had that prime, you know, who had firsthand knowledge and dealing with them? Don't you think that they're doing something different with these people? Don't you think that it's more of a terrorizing kind of thing for these abductees because they've been on the front lines of dealing with this phenomenon? Why would they go to civilians?
Well, that's what I was just trying to describe. In other words, they're just another source of potential information.
Okay.
Not that it would be strictly limited to whatever those people
okay.
might know.
Okay.
But they're just saying, okay, I mean, let's just deal with it hypothetically.
Right.
Corso says that there were crash saucers. Obviously, whoever possessed the crash saucers are going to try and figure out how they work.
Right.
Once they figure it out, that the design and functionality and the materials, in fact, themselves
right.
are all the product of what the human physiology and mental capacity of aliens would, you know,
right.
give birth to.
As an extension of their consciousness.
Then, once they were apprised of that, then they had to try and figure out how best to reconcile that from a human point of view, because as you well know, and I know that you study the metaphysical and the paranormal as well,
yeah.
you know only too well, that there are that amongst human beings, that kind of capability is extremely rare.
Right.
It is possible to train yourself to do certain levels of it,
mm-hmm.
but that's not what we're talking about.
Mm.
We're talking about a race or races of people who, by their very nature, are essentially like that. It's
right.
not that they do it in their spare time. Their sense of being itself
is that. Yes, is at
now,
that level, right.
Now, the reason why that's plausible, and there again, skeptics would deny all that because they don't like thinking that's possible, and the reason why, of course, is because the science that they know cannot duplicate that repeatedly in the laboratory to their satisfaction, but that doesn't mean it's not the case.
Exactly.
And if you study paranormal phenomena, you will find out that actually there are human beings that have come along once in a great while, that were actually very, very naturally adept. They didn't have to be trained in it. They just had a natural capability. And some of those people have been very thoroughly and scientifically documented. Most of the public don't know all about any number of those kind of people. But there are. If you look deep into the literature, you'll find references to them. And there, and based on that as a model, you can say that, well, if we do occasionally have adept humans who can do these capabilities, then that lends credibility to the reports that ETs do it by their very nature.
Yes.
You see what I mean?
Yes, absolutely.
And if you use that as a principle, and overall, within ufology at large, or within the various disciplines of study of ufology, using that very same principle, then you'll begin to see that the skeptical point of view doesn't hold any water, and there is truth to this.
Right. Wow, fantastic, Randy. Really, really amazing. Of course, because of your studies into McLuhan, et cetera, we understand that the technology of language, that we were able to do amazing things before the linear nature of language came in. So, you know, maybe it is at the base of Homo sapiens that we had something that was alien to us. Before the before language came in and destroyed the capability of us doing mind-to-mind transmissions, you know.
Yeah, well, one of the essential principles involved in what we would call the old religion, right?
Yeah,
was actually being much more in tune to the subtle energies.
That's right.
Psychically, intuitively,
right,
and otherwise, and that's why I say. That's the paranormal phenomena is very, very credible, but for whatever genetic reason, in this particular level of consciousness that we have in common today,
yes.
and have had for a few thousand years, it's not our essential, nature in every waking moment. It's kind of like, you might call it a recessive capability, for whatever reason.
Yes.
Frankly, my hypothesis also about the alien presence is that through a rapidly evolving technology, I believe that actually the aliens are provoking humans to go that quantum leap in that direction by virtue of kind of like the technological interface. Because if you can make a good case for the possibility that we're trying to replicate alien technology, in other words, to create our version of that, then that would be, by definition, leading a step towards that type of understanding. In other words, reconciling kind of like the physics of three dimensions or three or four dimensions to a level of technology wherein you have to be telepathic to use it.
Well,
one
second also, because we're going to go to a break, but let me just say this real quick. What you're talking about then, of course, is that we have the body technology to do that, which even, you know, blows the skeptics even beyond that, right? Because how could they even ask that? They can't ask that of an ant or something. They're asking that of a Homo sapien, which means that technology is there. And like you say, it is latent. It's something that we have forgotten about. On the lines, Randy Copang. We're discussing his fantastic book, collaboration with Melinda Leslie, who couldn't join us tonight but will be on soon because she, oh my God, the experiences that she talks about when she does lectures will make your nails curl. They are intense. What she talks about. The book is Camouflage Through Limited Disclosure, Deconstructing a Cover-Up of the Extraterrestrial Presence, Randy Copang, Melinda Leslie. This is KPFK 90.7 FM Los Angeles, 98.7 FM up there in Santa Barbara. Let's go ahead and take this quick break, and we'll be back with Randy in just a moment.
Where the past and the future converge. Go to www.radioalchemy.com, RadioAlchemy.com for streaming audio and more.
Yes, and get to Radio Alchemy through kpfk.org. Wonderful website, lots of news, lots of great stuff going on. And so, you know, make sure and go there and go to the Something's Happening program guide. Go to Political Night. Boom, you got Radio Alchemy and so much more. And Radio Alchemy, I think, has a link somewhere. But there's a number of ways to find us. But the idea is just to find us out there on the web at www.kpfk.org. Now, really quickly, on the Alchemy calendar of events, let me mention some things that are coming up. This Saturday, Chalmers Johnson is going to be in town, you guys. Chalmers Johnson, former CIA analyst, distinguished scholar, best-selling author, is going, you know, former Republican who has, thank God, deprogrammed himself and is out there speaking truth. He is going to be speaking at A Day of Peace in Whittier, California. That's April 21st, this Saturday at 1:30 p.m. at the First Friends Church in Whittier, California. Call 562-698-9805. 562-698-9805. Be there on Saturday at 1:30 to hear Chalmers Johnson talk about his newest book, Nemesis, The Last Days of the American Republic. Oh, my God. Well, he might be just right on with that. The Last Days of the American Republic, Nemesis, by Chalmers Johnson. He will be speaking Saturday in Whittier at the First Friends Church. For information, 562-698-9805. Coming up on Sunday, April 22nd, from 2 to 6 p.m., there is a teach-in at the University of Venice on the war and its impact on our community. It's at the Venice Methodist Church at 2210 Lincoln Boulevard. For information, call 310-399-2215. 310-399-2215. It's sponsored by the Venice Peace and Freedom Group. The featured speaker will be Dr. Dalia Wasfi. Dr. Dalia Wasfi is an Iraqi-American activist who was speaking out against the war in Iraq. She was born to a Jewish mother and an Iraqi father and spent her early childhood in Iraq under Saddam Hussein. And so there, you know, it's going to be an in-depth, amazing talk, and she'll be joined by a number of other speakers, too many to enumerate now, but celebrate Earth Day by stopping the war at the teach-in on the war and its impact on our community this Sunday, April 22nd, at the Venice Methodist Church. Call 310-399-2215, 310-399-2215. And finally, some fun stuff. An Evening with Five Funny Females is coming up on Thursday, April 26th, next Thursday at 7:30 p.m. at the Steinway Hall. It's going to be, Ronnie Jane will be host, Betty Salskine, Ann Rudolph, Vicky Judits, and Maureen Kane. Kane will be there giving you some laugh factors, something to lighten the mood. And so it's Tickling Adam's Rib, An Evening with Five Funny Females, next Thursday evening, 7:30 p.m. at Steinway Hall. And phone number is call Ronnie Jane at 310-836-7557. That's 310-836-7557. And for more information, you can go to the Culver City Democratic Club. www.ccdimclub.org. Just like it sounds. Call Ronnie Jane, 310-836-7557. Some good stuff happening for you all in this upcoming week. All right, we'll be back with Randy Copang in just a second. The book is called Camouflage Through Limited Disclosure, Deconstructing a Cover-Up of the Extraterrestrial Presence. We have the main author, Randy Copang, on the line. And so, Randy, yes, we left with another cliffhanger, sir. Continue what you were saying.
As long as we can keep our ducks in a row and not forget where we left off.
I know. Well, what you were talking about is still debunking those that are speculative, because you were saying that the ETs are, in a sense, helping us remember about the technology of our body, that we can communicate at a level that is with them, and that this is spurring, that they are, in a sense, challenging humankind to rediscover some of the more great abilities that we have latent.
Yeah, that's a good synopsis of it in a generic sense.
Yes.
In Melinda's research, one of the technological themes that she develops is this concept which we describe as the mental interface technology, or the mental interface arrangement, wherein if we were to take a hypothetical ET craft, and in fact there has been quite a bit of detail about specifically about the crash that is reportedly to have occurred in Roswell, New Mexico, or in the vicinity of Roswell, because actually the evidence shows that any number of craft crashed within like a couple of weeks there in July of 47,
right,
throughout the vicinity of New Mexico, and the Roswell one was only one of them, and there was a good reason for that. I don't know if we have time to go into that now, although I will give credit to the very well-known journalist and Emmy Award winner and ufologist Linda Moulton Howe, because she an account that she has been presenting for the last year or so, or a couple of years, actually fleshes the crash saucer phenomena out much more than it has ever been fleshed out before, as a result of a manuscript that was written by a former New Mexico state legislator named J. Andrew Kistner. And he was a state legislator there for a number of years, and he got wind of the whole phenomenon of the crash saucers and kind of like conducted his own semi-official, I mean he was a state official, but he conducted an investigation into the credibility of that in light of all the test facilities that are located in New Mexico and were located in there, you know, since the Manhattan Project, and right on through after World War II. And he actually has done a very good job of filling in a lot of gaps in our knowledge about the phenomena of crash saucers, because on the one hand, it doesn't seem plausible. If aliens are so smart that came here from golly knows where, then why would they come here and then crash? Well, there is an explanation for that, which heretofore was not did not occur. And thanks to Andrew Kistner, we now have a much more substantial body of evidence about that.
What was it?
That basically, there's kind of like two explanations that were happening simultaneously. I'll refer to the smallest of the two first. And that was the product, some of them, very few, apparently were caused the crash through apparently gravitational anomalies on planet Earth that were not readily apparent. And when they flew into them unknowingly, their navigation was fouled up, and they lost navigation control of the craft. There's evidence for that.
Okay.
But that only would explain a few. Most all the rest of them occurred because humans figured out how to shoot them down.
Yes. Okay. Now, with just regular sling blade rockets, or did we at that point have some kind of beam weapon?
Well, there's a number of theories as to or allegations. Maybe I should put it that way. No, strike theories. They're more like allegations by various people. In fact, recently there was a variation on the theme of it proposed only a few nights ago on the Art Bell Show by someone who was a former guest on your program, David Cereda.
Yeah.
He apparently has been interviewing a former quote-unquote insider about that, and he has a variation on a theme to suggest along the lines, but basically the principle is similar. What Kistner unearthed, and that is that the ETs were attracted to the activities of humans at White Sands in Mexico, both in terms of their nuclear weapons research and also in terms of their development of rocket technology after World War II. And so this is one of the areas where humans totally verified the fact of what this was all about. And so according to Kistner, what they did, and he pretty much verified this absolutely as the case, is that they built four very, very high-intensity microwave radar facilities at different points in the state of New Mexico, and they were all focused in towards the area of White Sands, New Mexico, with the intention of the possibility that it was like net fishing in the ocean. In other words, they would be conducting their tests, which they deduced would attract the saucers, and then they would crank up their high-intensity radar, and then they discovered that their high-intensity radar would there again foul up the navigational technology of the saucers and cause them to crash. And apparently it worked. And there is a substantial degree of evidence for it. In fact, as you may know, in my own book, since I couldn't it wouldn't be unlikely to be able to verify what Kistner is reporting, because he apparently got a lot of access to either documents or the personal views of people who were involved in the test facilities that he interviewed, and it would be difficult to verify them independently. But what I did was I just went back to the old literature since the 50s, and I found out, as I spell out quite in detail, as from a historical point of view, that actually even in the 50s, there were reports coming out and documented in books about the fact that humans figured out how to cause saucers to crash with radar. And so I thought that was remarkable, because Kistner wrote this manuscript about all this, but he has yet to publish it.
You know what, darling?
For whatever reason, he gave it to Linda Howe, and so she's just been doing public lecturing about it. But
brilliant.
But I feel confident in having verified the likelihood of it, because it was being reported 50 years ago.
Yes, dear. My gosh, you know what? Time, as usual, has flown, Randy.
Okay.
So that just means, dagnabbit, that you're coming back, and Melinda's coming back, and we didn't even get to talk about the contribution that you found that Bill Uhouse brought to this. So obviously we have to continue this. It's been really fascinating listening to the research that you've been doing. And thank you so much, Randy, for compiling this. I mean, really, really great work. It's very exciting work that you're doing.
Well, thank you very much. I appreciate that, and my hat's off to you and Roy, and I look forward to being here again with Melinda, perhaps.
Oh, yes, absolutely, and very soon. And is Bill Uhouse still with us?
Bill Uhouse is a legitimate insider. I interviewed his son.
Is he still with us?
Appendix in the book.
He's
alive. He's 83 years old, and he's not retired.
Oh, my goodness.
Working on the Inside Project. By the way, can I give out a splash page web address for my
book? Yes, yes. Oh, I'm sorry. Please.
Okay. They can see excerpts and photographs of the testing that I talk about at ANW.com/RK/CAMO.
Camo. Okay. ANW/what?
No, ANW.com.
Okay, .com.
/RK.
RK, spell that.
RK.
Oh, just RK.
My initials.
Oh, your name. Okay, Randy Copang. I thought, okay, it was
a word. /CAMO.
CAMO. Okay, great. ANW facebook.com/RK as in Randy Copang /CAMO. All right, darlings.
Thank you very much.
Yes, Randy, have a great night.
Goodbye.
Okay. All right, darlings. Wow, gotta go. Much love. See you next week.
You've been listening to Radio Alchemy with your host, Evan Ray. Be sure to visit our website, www.radioalchemy.com, and join us next week for more mind-blowing revelations from the fringe.